So it's back to, as I say, work talking again. And it's, as many of you know, that having periods of retreat are not just goofing off. It's not just even just enjoying myself, which I do immensely on retreats. But it's also like an example to each one of you as well. Because our life has to be balanced. Balanced with time which we serve, giving to others, giving our life, our energy, all our effort to other people or to a community to make a better world. But also time for ourselves as well. And I've often noticed when that balance is not preserved, that's where many people get upset, angry, either ill health in their mind or ill health in their body. I just remembered just at the end of the meditation a saying from this very famous philosopher and mathematician who once said that all the problems of human beings, all the problems come from not knowing how to sit still. And I thought, what a beautiful saying that is. And imagine what would happen if we have all of the people in our parliaments that sit still for half an hour. Quiet. Because what happens then is people become peaceful, they become happy, they become very sensitive to the world around you. And when you become very sensitive to what's happening around you, wisdom arises, and all the reasons why people argue with each other or have conflict, that all sort of seems to be so silly and just people not understanding each other because they don't understand themselves. So just a few moments of peace does wonders to ending conflict either within yourself or between people or between you and your world. In other words, peace is the end of conflict. It's again the sense of harmony. But, as Buddhism often taught, you don't have to make a perfect world to have peace and harmony. In fact, if you try and make the world perfect first of all, if you try and get everything just right, if I try and make my monastery just right and get people just right, you know what I mean by getting people just right? People to see what I see. In other words, to agree with me. People are really stupid when they don't agree with me. Same with you, isn't it? Have you ever found that out? The cause of stupidity in this world is people don't agree with you. But you don't have to have everybody agreeing with you. You don't have to have everybody walking in the same direction to have peace and harmony in this world. So this is the way to find the end of conflict, peace and harmony, with everybody just being themselves, with life being themselves. Because sometimes, if you want to try and fix everything up first of all, and then find peace, you'll find that your whole life will be trying to fix things up, trying to settle disputes, trying to argue with people. And you find that just wastes so much time. There has to be another way. There's too many wars, there's too many arguments in this world. And where can ever we find a peaceful world? And of course, we just start in our home. There's too many arguments in your home. And where can you ever find a peaceful place to live? And more importantly, there's always arguments inside your head. You know, the sort of the conflict within. All coming from the same place. We don't know how to sit still and understand things. A story which comes to mind is a story of, it's one of those stories in that old Opening the Door of Your Heart book. The story of the Japanese garden. There was, many of you who've ever been to Japan know they're famous for their gardens. In fact, at our retreat center down at Jhana Grove, we actually asked this Japanese man to do our gardens for us. He's done a really nice job. Not finished yet, but to do the landscaping there. Japanese seem to have just this knack of knowing just how to balance plants, nature, to get this beautiful, like natural, but even better than natural look. But anyway, there was the most famous garden in the whole of Japan. People would travel all from all over the country. They'd come internationally to see this garden, which was just magnificent. And one day, this old meditation monk, he wanted to find out what the secret was of this garden. What did this gardener who was a monk do, which no one else did? So he arrived very early in the morning. He climbed over the wall and hid behind a bush to try and discover the secret of the most magnificent garden in the whole of Japan. And just after dawn, he saw a monk come out from the temple. And he saw the monk had two baskets. And he watched from behind the bush without being seen this gardening monk go to this garden, which was like in a courtyard with this big tree in the middle. And he would collect every leaf and twig which had fallen the night before. But he wouldn't just throw them away. He'd examine every leaf and twig first of all. And if he thought that the leaf was beautiful, had artistic merit, if he thought the twig was just bent in the right direction, he would put it in the good basket. If it wasn't useful, he'd put it in the rubbish basket. He spent about 3 hours meticulously, painstakingly, taking up every leaf and twig which fell, dividing them into the two baskets. And then he took the rubbish basket to the back of the temple, emptied it on the compost, and he placed the other basket down. He rested to take tea and meditate, because the next part was the most important. For another 3 hours, he took the basket with the artistic, beautiful leaves and twigs, and he placed them individually around the garden, just one by one. And he was one of these people who had this artistic sensitivity. He was a maestro of color and shape and arrangement. Sometimes, so I heard, he would look at a leaf for 5 minutes, realizing that something was wrong. He would just turn it a few degrees and smile. Now that was the right place for it. That's how careful he was. That's why it took her 3 hours to place every leaf and twig just in the right place. And the result was absolutely out of this world. Magnificent. It was beautiful. It was a work of art. And that was when he would open the garden up for visitors. But not this day. Because as soon as he was finished, the old monk came out. Now in all these stories, always be careful of old monks. And this old monk lived up to the reputation. Because he came up and said to this gardening monk, he said, I've been watching you for so many hours. And your garden, he said, your garden is almost perfect. And at those words, almost perfect, that poor young gardening monk, his face went white, his jaw dropped, his lips started to quiver. What do you mean? Almost perfect. And he fell to the ground as a good Buddhist does. And he bowed to this old monk and begged him, please tell me how to make this garden more perfect. You really want to know? Said the old monk. Yes! It was a stupid thing to say yes to the old monk. Because the old monk strode into the middle of the garden, which had been painstakingly set leaf by leaf, twig by twig, and he put his still strong arms around the tree in the middle and shook the hell out of it. Leaves and twigs fell all over the place. That poor gardening monk went white again. The whole garden was ruined. That's what the gardening monk thought. But the wise old monk looked at the mess, smiled and said, "Now, that's perfect." I love that story. That's why I like repeating it today. Because that's what perfection truly is. When it's all over the place, like this temple here. Sometimes there's leaves all over the place, bits of grass coming up here. Sometimes the grass is coming out of the gutter. But it doesn't matter, it's a beautiful, perfect place. Just like you. Sometimes you have to spend a lot of money at the beauty parlor, trying to get this fixed up and that fixed up. Sometimes you've got to spend a lot of money on your house trying to fix it up. But isn't it wonderful to look at your house this evening as you go home? With all the leaves which need to be scraped up, with all the dishes which need to be washed, with all the rubbish there, and say, "Ah, now that's perfect." Or to look at yourself in a mirror, getting old, grey, with crow's feet in your eyes, with all your breasts sagging, with all your tummy getting fatter and fatter every year, and look at you and say, "That's perfect." Now you know how to end conflict. So you can look at your old dumpy wife. You can look at your thin and weedy, frail husband and say, "I love you, darling, because you're just perfect." Otherwise you have conflict, don't you? And you can do that. Because as a Buddhist monk, you realize now that's the only place you can ever find perfection. You don't have to get everything just so to have peace. And that's also why that when, you know, people argue with each other, people have got differences of opinion. You know, look at, it's so hard to find harmony in this world, isn't it? Where everybody thinks the same. And, you know, it just, that's one of the reasons why I encourage, you know, that Hugh, when we have, you know, the monks away, don't get other Buddhists in here, get other people in here. Just, you know, to actually have more people to hear so we can have a bit more harmony. I'm very proud that in this temple we've had Muslims, we have Christians, we have Jewish people. Yeah, not yet, next year. Oh, that's right. I did actually ask you to invite, you know, one of my mates, Moshi, but he was over in China at the time, so he was studying over there, couldn't come. But next year. Because actually when we meet together, you know, we have harmony, we can have a great time together. It reminds me of a story I read during my rains retreat. There was actually this Buddhist monk and a Christian and a Jew. And, you know, they went to one of these interfaith meetings, and they became friendly. They thought it's really important for like the harmony in this world. Religions are the cause of so many conflicts in our planet. And surely, you know, religious leaders should get their act together and be friends together. So, you know, they decided to sort of meet every week in one person's house just to have a bit more sort of understanding and harmony. And, you know, one thing led to another, and they got quite social. And, you know, just they started playing cards and started playing poker. They got a little bit of a gambling den going. And that was a bit illegal. And one day, you know, somebody dobbed them in, the police came around and got busted. So there they were in the Supreme Court, you know, being sort of tried for gambling illegally. So it was actually, it was a Christian, was the first, you know, in the witness stand. And the judge looked at him and said, "You know, you're a religious person. Were you gambling?" And he quickly looked up and to heaven and said, "God forgive me." "No," he said. And the Jewish guy was the next, the rabbi. And the judge asked him the same question. "You know, you're also a religious leader. Were you gambling?" He crossed his fingers behind his back. "No, your Lord, no, your Lord." And then the Buddhist was the last. And he said, "You Buddhists, you're supposed to keep these five precepts. I know those five precepts. Number four is you're not supposed to lie. Now, Buddhist monk, were you gambling?" And the Buddhist monk replied, "With whom?"
Buddhist monks are very smart.
But when I read the story, it wasn't the Buddhist monk, I think it was the Jewish guy who got the right answer at the end. But anyhow, we have to meet with people we disagree with and allow that disagreement to occur. And to realize this, the only way we can have peace and harmony is to have a wisdom. Yes, arguments happen, disagreements are there, but that's perfect to have disagreements. It's perfect to have arguments. Because if we think that we shouldn't have these arguments and disagreements, you'll find that there'll always be a lot of conflict there. And when I say it's okay to have disagreements, it's okay to have arguments, sometimes that we do that. I was contemplating this today because some of you may remember that this is an anniversary day today, the 22nd of October. 12 months ago, sort of, we did the first bhikkhuni ordination of bhikkhunis. And that caused a lot of conflict, especially for me. Not here, I mean, this was people very behind this, but some internationally. And sometimes you think, well, what was that all about? And as for me, because I was right involved in the middle of it, sometimes during this rains retreat, I was sort of contemplating, trying to understand why anybody would be upset at that. Not to think that they were wrong, because when you think that they're imperfect and I'm perfect, there's no way you can ever end any conflict. You had to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, in their heart, in their mind, understand where they were coming from, why they were coming from this, why they were saying this, to really empathize with them. To respect your enemy. That's such a tough thing to do. But you have to make that leap if you're going to understand the nature of conflict and their solution. You've got to get your head inside that of a terrorist bomber. You've got to get your head inside one of those people in that, was it Lord's Resistance Army, who cut off people's hands and arms. You've got to get underneath them to understand them. It's one of the toughest things to do. But I remember many years ago, one of the early years I was a Buddhist monk, something which really inspired me was a poem by Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh. Now, you know, he was a Vietnamese monk. And he was, in his early years, before he became famous, he was really looking after the Vietnamese community who had escaped from Vietnam on boats, risking their lives. Many of them didn't make it. The boats were even worse than they are these days. Most people died at sea. Those people who survived were raped by Thai pirates. Their money, their collections disappeared. It was a terrible, terrible time. And if there's any Vietnamese people here, you know, you understand what I mean. And this monk wrote this poem, which was both shocking. It just spanned me around, but gave me an insight into how such conflicts can be resolved. I can't remember the poem properly, but it was something like, I am the refugee in a boat tossed on the waves. I am the woman pregnant in that boat. I am the woman raped by the Thai pirate. I am the Thai pirate raping this woman. I am the Thai pirate stealing the money. I am all of those people. It was making that leap, which I couldn't make before. Leap into the impossible. Leap into the repugnant. Leap beyond the boundaries you've set to get underneath and understand. Only then could there be any resolution. Unfortunately, in our Western world, we have this terrible concept of justice, which is revenge. The eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Somebody who's done something like that needs to be punished for it. That's Western, it's not Buddhist. One thing which was really, again, shocked me, there was no concept of punishment in Buddhism. There was no revenge. I first found that out when I, as a monk, I had to understand, you know, the rules which monks live by. And you know, you can break a rule. What happens if you break a rule as a monk? You know, are you whipped? Are you sort of put in a dungeon? Are you sort of stopped being fed? There was no punishment at all. You just had to acknowledge you made a mistake. Being up for the service, you were given forgiveness all the time, and just advise strategies so you don't do the same thing again. It was beautiful and highly effective. When in a conflict, you look for getting your own back, you look for punishment, you look for hurting somebody else, you're just making that conflict go on and on and on. When you try and punish those people, you find you're just having more conflict. As far as justice is concerned, as I mentioned before, here, sitting here, if you're a Christian, God will settle the matter. If you're a Muslim, Allah will sort it out. If you're a Buddhist, karma gets them. You don't have to worry about revenge. Karma will get them. You know that. And if you don't believe in any of that, if you're one of these secular people, atheists, you know, if you've done something bad, you'll have to be under psychotherapy for years before you get your head together. And that's very expensive. In other words, that no one gets away with anything. There's always a natural justice which happens in spite of any courts or legal systems. You know that. I know that. What that understanding gives us is the freedom to forgive. The freedom to put aside the rod, as the Buddha said, and not to need to punish. Otherwise, conflicts never end if we think our opponent has not been punished enough yet. So, put aside that punishment business. And instead, we realize that what we truly want is not justice. We don't want tit for tat. We want to make sure this never happens again. To put forth what we call these strategies in place to make sure that we don't have the rapes at sea, the piracy. We don't have the big conflicts in this world. We don't have people, suicide bombers, blowing people up or slamming big 707s into big high-rise buildings. And we want to have a peaceful world. Now, straight away, what I've said is something which I've called reordering priorities. It's actually standing back and thinking and understanding what is really important. Being right is not that important. Justice, or rather revenge, is not that important. Once you look at the priorities, what is more important, what is more valuable, then conflict can be ended. Conflict usually continues when people have got the wrong priorities. Mostly, you know, my ego. You can't do this to me. You know, I am right. You know, you guys are wrong. Why do you even think like this? It says in the book, it says in this. Always trying to justify yourself. You are not so important. There's other things which are more important than you. You know what's more important than you? Us. Us is the most valuable thing. There's often saying marriages, you should never think of yourself in a relationship, nor should you ever think of your partner in a relationship. You should only think of us. Us is the most important. In a monastery, the abbot is not the most important person, unfortunately, because that's me. You know, sometimes when I went to go and visit the Benedictine monastery in New Norcia, you know, they've got rules of obedience there. Whatever the abbot says, you've got to agree to. And I thought, that's a really good idea. So I tried to impose it in Bodhinyana, but they wouldn't have a word of it. Never mind, I wouldn't want that anyway. That would be terrible if people always agreed with me. That would be like a cult. And so if ever you keep an agreement, if you don't argue with me, I'll get very upset. But not too much, please. So instead of having like obedience, which is all about me, we have like what we call like us is the most important. And you all know that in a relationship, it's not about me, it's not about him or her, it's always about us. In a family, that's why the family unit used to be so strong, because it was about us, a group. Human beings, it's all about us. The bigger that us, the more important it is. And that becomes my priority, the welfare and benefit, well-being of us, not me. So being right is not important. When it's all about us, who's right and who's wrong doesn't really count. What's important in us is our peace, our happiness, our prosperity. That means you can let go of so much when you get the right priorities. By letting go, I mean you can forgive so much. Sometimes people keep asking me, how on earth can you forgive people what they've done? Nevin Tiknyat Han, when he was talking about the rapist, he was saying, get underneath the skin of that person, where they're coming from, why they're doing that, hard though that may be, to understand that it's all about us, which includes those people. When you make that sort of jump, there's no barrier to the end of conflict. So, where we rearrange our priorities, us and the harmony and well-being of us are most important. We can tend to forgive. We can to do something which the Buddha, this was 25 centuries ago, when he laid down the Vinaya, this is the rules for the monks and the nuns, he did say that there was something which, this is actually the word of the Buddha, I mean, he called it covering over with grass, tinawatara koti. Don't keep on bringing it up again and again and again. Let it lie. Let it be covered over with grass. Let it just change and grow. Because we keep holding on to those differences of the past, who was right and who was wrong. It's just like, as they say, a cancer which eats you up from within. You get no peace, you get no happiness, and you can't contribute to the peace and happiness of the world. When there's conflict inside of you, when there's unfinished business, you can never be free. So the end of that conflict comes through that forgiveness, through that letting go, which comes from reordering your priorities by realizing what's truly important in this world. And unfortunately, that many people just still haven't got those priorities right. We always think that my religion is the only religion. My footy team is the only footy team which matters. My country is the only country which matters. There's always this my. Sometimes even on, now when we do have footy teams, when we do have, what do you have recently, Commonwealth Games, when you do have these sporting matches, sometimes I always think the best result is a draw. When no one wins. Because when no one wins, no one loses. So when we sort of give up that sort of competition, when we give up that just wanting to be the best, when we give up that wanting to be the winner, I think then we can have a bit of peace in this world. It might be a boring world. That's why, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, I used to play sports, but, you know, even playing soccer, you know, that just, I didn't have any competitive streak in me. So, you know, you play for fun. But, you know, that was all. And if, you know, the last game of soccer I played, this was at a university in Cambridge, the last game of soccer I played was when 11 of our team turned up and only 9 of their team turned up. So it was a very one-sided game. I think it was about, we were up about 6 or 7 nil at half-time. And so at the half-time break for 10 minutes, I went over to my captain and I said, look, can I please play for the other side in the second half so we can have a, you know, a decent game? And he swore at me. And he said, you can't do that. You can't play for the other team. And I gave up then. I wouldn't play anymore. Instead, I actually tried another sport. And actually, this is the only sport which I actually represented Cambridge. Again, you know, Cambridge and Oxford, we always used to have these matches, these competitions together. And, you know, this is the only sport which I represented Cambridge against Oxford. Tiddlywinks. That's true. Because you couldn't be competitive when you're playing tiddlywinks. It was for fun. No, how can you be? No, it was just a kids' game. We did, you know, most of the time it was just get the game over as soon as possible so we can, you know, go to the bar. You know, those were the days before I became a monk, before I had five precepts. But at least you could not be competitive playing tiddlywinks. So that's the one which I supported, you know, started being a Buddhist, I suppose. But too much competition, too much ego, too much conflict. It doesn't matter if you're right, because it's all about us and having a good game rather than just, you know, being the winner. It's all about us having a sense of harmony in the family rather than who's right and who's wrong. In a relationship, about us, for goodness sake. Change the priorities, and then conflict is very easily overcome. And obviously that sometimes we just do carry around the pain of the past far too much. I don't know why we keep remembering all the stuff of the past which went wrong, the pain of the past. Again, when you just become still for a while, you think, why am I doing that? Why do, when I look at the past and I remember what happened, do I remember all the terrible things which happened in my relationship with my ex? Why do I always remember this of the difficult times I had growing up? Why do I always remember all of the times I was cheated? If you keep remembering like that, you get very angry. You get spiritually very weak, stunting, crippled, you might say, simply because you're not using your mind in a wise and compassionate way. It is why that, you know, as a Buddhist, I was taught to let all that pain of the past go. And if you're going to carry anything, if you're going to be attached to anything, carry the beautiful stuff of your past, the happy times you had. Why not? And you can do that. It's very easy to do. When you have photographs, which you have in your albums, if you still have them in albums or you have on your USB stick, whatever you have it on these days. Do you have, you know, those albums, you know, the photo of the time you got divorced? No, you have the photo of the, you know, the time you got married. You know, do you have the sort of the photograph of the time you got kicked out of university for failing? No, you have the time you got given your degree. So these are the photographs we have. Why do we have those photographs? Because they bring about happy memories. So in the same criteria which you use to fill your photograph albums at home, use the same selection process to keep your memory in your head. Just keep the happy photographs of your life. Why not? So that's what I've done in my life. Sometimes actually, this is actually true. I'm letting you into another secret. Sometimes people send me these letters of complaint. Ajahn Brahm, you told a terrible joke again. And again, and again, and again. Ajahn Brahm, you used the shit word. Ajahn Brahm, you did this. And sometimes they write me these letters. Those letters, actually, I burn them straight away. But when they write these letters, Ajahn Brahm, you're such a great monk. Oh, you really helped me. You saved my life. I keep those. I've got this whole cupboard in there with all my family. Why not? Makes sense to me. So what you're doing actually there, and what happens when you do things like that? What happens when you do things like that? It means you're encouraging more goodness. because you want more fan mail, good letters, you actually have to work harder to get the fan mail. Give more good talks, be more kind, save more lives, do more. Actually, it makes you a much more positive person, a more successful person in your chosen field. You actually do more. Which is why that even today, I came here early, there was another funeral service. Now, each one of you were very good. At the beginning of this rains retreat period, I asked each one of you here, please don't die. Few people broke the rule, but it's only a few, didn't matter. But there's another funeral today. And again, you know, that funeral service, that story I say about the concert. It's a wonderful way of understanding how to solve the conflict between life and death. The story of the concert. It's a great story, and I tell it every funeral, and I actually get moved by it when I say it. Because my father died when I was 16, and I loved him very much. Was, you know the opening the door of your heart story came from him. And when he died, I never cried. Never cried since. Never felt like crying. It was very hard for me to understand what I felt. But as a monk, you had the time to contemplate. It was one of those things I remembered as a monk. I had the time to try and understand what I felt and why. And I soon figured it out. And the way we explain things is actually using similes. And similes are stories. That's why I like telling stories, because stories are just much closer descriptions to real life than anything else. So it was a story of the concert. A young man growing up in London, I loved music and used to go to all these concerts. And I always remember the end of the concert, standing up, clapping, shouting for more. And the band, the orchestra, they would play a little bit longer for you, 5 or 10 minutes, just like my dad did. He kept going a few days longer for us, for his family. But then at the end of the encore came the time when the orchestra, the band, had to pack up the instruments and go home. The time when my dad had to die and leave us. But every time I walked out of a concert hall or club or pub, every time, even though I knew I'd never hear that great music again, I never cried. I went to some great concerts in London. I remember actually going on radio here, 6PR, and telling one of the great concerts I went to, this is for the people of my generation, it was at the Roundhouse in Chalk Farm, London. 2 hours of the Doors, followed by 2 hours of Jefferson Airplane. Another 2 hours of Doors, another 2 hours of Airplane. 8 hours of these great rock bands. Oh, that was really neat. And I forget who it was, one of the presenters there. His jaw was dropping. You lucky. Because he loved that. But anyway, I had just great concerts in those days. And of course, at the end of the concert, you never cried. I never felt sad. I felt how lucky I was to have been there. What a great performance that was. How fortunate. And that's exactly how I felt when my father died. Exactly, like the end of a great concert. I was not looking at what had been taken away, looking what I had. What I had was immense. And I felt so lucky, so fortunate, so blessed. So I never had the conflict between life and death. Why? Because I never collected the bad stuff, only the good stuff. I collected the happy photographs of the time I had with that man. I kept all the rotten photographs. I never put those in my album. And that gave me this great sense of gratitude. When I had that sense of gratitude, that positive part of life, there was no conflict anymore. All those people who complained about, you know, me, my involvement with the Bhikkhuni ordination 12 months ago, I don't collect, you know, those bad words or bad feelings or bad actions. I just collect the beautiful memories, the wonderful times you had with, you know, Ajahn Yana and Ajahn Sumedho and all those other people. That's what I collect. Those are the only things I put in my photo album. That way, there can be the end of conflict. When you collect the bad stuff, you know, there's business to be done. It's not settled yet. When you have grief because you're in conflict with the fact that someone you love very dearly has died and not here anymore. When you have conflict because someone has treated you badly and they shouldn't have done that. When you have conflict because there's been some trauma in your past, where can you have freedom? So you let that stuff just disappear. And you focus more on the beautiful stuff, which is actually much bigger. The death of my father was just over a few days. His life was many, many years. All the time I've known these great monks who were my friends was such a long time. It's only a short, you know, blip on our relationship when they got angry with me about, you know, helping with the ordination of the nuns. The time which you've had with your partner, so many years of happiness and joy and great memories. And why is it one time they misbehave and that's all you think about? And you throw away that relationship. It never made sense to me. In fact, I said that in that first story of the book, The Two Bad Bricks in the Wall. Two bad bricks is not reason enough to destroy a wall. But it's 998 good bricks. Two bad bricks is not enough to deserve conflict. We let that go. When you let that go, it's amazing what happens. It means that you can actually understand the rapist. You can love the suicide bomber. Now that's such a big jump for many people. But you can do that. Which is a beautiful thing to do, because in that great jump from conflict, from the good, the bad, and this black and white, this evil and this holy stuff, when you can make that jump, then there can be the end of the problem. Because you find in your life when you don't make that jump, those two extremes will still exist, of us and them, of me and my enemies. But when you make that jump, there are no more rapes. There are no more suicide bombers. Because they can only exist when there's me and them. When there's us, there can be no more conflict, no more harm. How can I ever harm us? Because I'm part of it. When we separate ourselves from others, when we say, I'm a Buddhist, Frank Sheehan is a Christian, Moshe Bernstein is a Jew. When we separate ourselves like that, then we can have conflict. When we see what we have in common, then it's only us. There's this great sense of friendship and peace. This is what I have had to do in my life as a monk. Try and not preserve sort of that which separates me from others. To acknowledge that, but actually to try and jump that barrier. It's the same when, you know, I'm a man and half of you are girls. To try and jump that barrier so that you can feel what it's like to be a girl. So you can actually see what we have in common. So you can actually get beyond those barriers which separate people, which divide people, which continue the conflict there. Set the priorities, it's all about us. And develop the wisdom to see that which we have in common enough to see that that far outweighs that which separates us. The good bricks, what we have in common, far outweighs the two bad bricks which separate us. Seeing that means there is a possibility for peace and harmony. But you don't stop that conflict by trying to convince the other person they're right. Or not, that's wrong, isn't it? Or that you're right and they're wrong. Whoever it is. I always get confused. Who is right and who's wrong? You know what my teacher used to say, Ajahn Chah? Whenever there was an argument, he'd look at the two people and said, you're right, but you're not correct. You're correct, but you're not right. I always like that one, you know. You're right, but not correct. Or you're correct, but not right. So you know, it's halfway between being right and wrong, because no one's right, no one's wrong. They're always halfway in between somewhere, you know, the middle way. So wouldn't it be wonderful if that happened in Parliament? You know, Mr. Abbott said, "No, Mrs. Gillard, you're right but not correct. But you're correct but not right, Mr. Abbott." Because none of them are right, none of them are wrong. They're all just good people trying to do their best. So there we can actually end some of this conflict. And conflict, it just really sucks, doesn't it? You know, just these are people you love and you like, and we want to live in harmony and peace together. We've got to live in harmony and peace in this world. If we don't get on together, what's this world going to be? Now, one of the other great stories from Open the Door of Your Heart was, Lena's over here, you remember Janice, years and years and years ago when I first came here, 26 years ago now I think this happened. Janice was from Canada, came with her husband. He was working up in the mines somewhere, or some engineer on a contract. When it finished, they had to go back home to Canada. The young couple, and they were very smart, very wise. Instead of doing what most people would do, get an air ticket, they decided, no, let's sell the little house we have and use the money to buy a boat. So they got a yacht. Idea, let's sail to Vancouver in Canada. When we get there, sell the yacht. We got our deposit for the next house. What a brilliant idea. And you have an adventure of a lifetime. Imagine that, my sailing from Perth, you know, over to the north of Australia, and then through the South Seas, over to, you know, maybe up the Atlantic coast, eventually up to Vancouver. Like a journey of a lifetime. And on the cheap too, because you know, you buy the boat, you sell it when you get to the other end. Brilliant idea. And of course, you know, they wrote to us when they arrived safely back in Vancouver. But what Janice said in the story, you know, in her letter, a brilliant thing happened in the middle of the ocean. Their engine stalled. Now, actually, I should have said that Janice and her husband, they teamed up with another couple, two married couples, you know, to help on the journey. So in the middle of the ocean, so the engine stalled. They were becalmed. They couldn't go anywhere. Now, this was 26 years ago. In the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you can't call up the RAC. You're stuck. You have to fix it up for yourself. No satellite phones. So you're in big trouble. But, you know, they had a good toolkit and they knew what they were doing. And so the two guys went into the engine room to sort out the problem with the engine. The two girls apparently were on deck reading magazines. Sexist, but that was 26 years ago. So, two guys in the engine room. Now, any of you guys who've ever tried to fix up an engine, you know that sometimes, as I said in the book, it just does not want to be fixed up. And they were getting more and more frustrated. Maybe you haven't tried to fix up an engine of a boat, but maybe you try to fix up your computer. And you start swearing. That's what these guys did. They started swearing. Because they were getting frustrated. And frustration led to blaming each other. It's your fault, stupid. And blaming each other soon led to a full-on argument. And the argument got to such a high level of conflict that one of them threw down their wrench in anger and said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." And this actually occurred. He was so mad with his rage, he went to his cabin, he actually changed, cleaned up, because he's all dirty, changed into his best clothes, packed his bags, and appeared on deck carrying his two suitcases. And the two women almost fell off the boat laughing. Because he looked around, and there was ocean in all directions as far as you could see. There's no place to go. So he had only one choice. Red in the face with embarrassment, he turned around, went back to his cabin, got back, changed back into his work clothes, back into the engine room to help out. And they ended that voyage as they began, the best of friends. And I love that story, because that's like our world. We're like a boat in the ocean. There's nowhere to go. You may think, right, that's it, I'm leaving. Where are you going to go to? Instead, go back into the engine room. Help your enemy fix up the problem. That's a very inspiring story because it gave another indication of just how conflict ends. When you can walk away, when you can run away, when there's some place to go, you're missing a wonderful opportunity. Instead, if it's at all possible, especially in the bigger conflicts of our world, we don't have places to go anymore. We have to fix up the conflicts. And we only can do that by working on them together. The priority is not who's right, but it's fixing up the engine and completing our voyage. If we don't, we all sink. When we change the priorities, where harmony and peace becomes paramount, much more important than being right, we realize that blame doesn't really help at all. When we realize it's all about us, that's a priority. And us, the big us, not my religion, not my race, not my country, but us. And not just even human beings, but the animal world, the environment, us, the big us. When we realize that, there's no conflict which we can't end. There is a possibility. If you're at peace, you can see that. When you're right in the middle of things, thinking, worrying, fighting, you can never see those things, which is why it's wonderful to have time when you go on a retreat. Time where you just stand back. Because when you stand back from life, when you're just by yourself in the stillness of your own mind, there you can actually see the biggest problems in the world can be solved. Just reordering your priorities, seeing the bigger picture, and realizing it's not about egos, not about me, my gender, my religion, or my race. It's all about us. Get those priorities right, we can have a very peaceful and happy world. Don't give up hope. There is a way, there is a path. Thank you for listening. Okay, does anyone disagree with that? Let's have some conflict. Any questions about the talk this evening? Yes, thank you. Okay, are you repressing the bad memories by just focusing on the good memories? Just going back to the simile of that brick wall which I laid 27 years ago, it was true there were two bad bricks and 998 good bricks. No, actually 998, quite a few more than that, but that was just what the person said. But for me, every time I looked at that wall and thought of it, it was just the two bad ones. And I realize it's our human nature, unless we're sort of taught otherwise, or we come to this place every Friday night, we will always be focusing on the negativity and what went wrong. Far more than what went right. To balance that, you have to deliberately just collect the good photographs. Why is it that when somebody dies, people lose it and get into such great grief? You may have known your father for 16 years. Why is it a couple of days spoils that whole life? So the truth of the matter is, I've noticed that most of the time, of your life, of the relationship, you're having a wonderful time. The truth is, the good does outweigh the bad in nearly all cases. Which is why I say, just remember that and conflict can be ended. Any other questions? Going for the second time, for the third time. Gone. Okay, so thank you for listening. Another talk next week. Bless the Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang namassami. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namami.